Thank you for downloading this podcast from policyreview.tv.
And hopefully that will inspire you in terms of questions and wanting to find out more. Roving Mike, so if you could just say who you are and which organisation you're from. First question here, the second row. Are there any other questions? We're going to take in groups of three. Yes?
Good morning. My name is Trevor Mosses. I work for Croydon Council, Head of Commission for Older People. I was interested in your last bit about notification of people who are running out of funding. As a commission, the problem we have is, of course, the prices are much higher for people who are self-funders, and then going down to our usual prices, of course, it's difficult both for the provider and for people themselves who, in some circumstances, you would say, I'm sorry, we have to move because of the prices in Croydon are massively different. How does this system manage that?
Okay, before we answer that, I've got a couple more questions for the woman there. Anyone else? And someone at the back as well. Yeah.
Hello, my name's June Cathchild from the Runsuckers Association. I'm interested in how a non-profit company such as Paying for Care is actually funded. Is it a social enterprise? Are you the only company in the market at the moment? And just a slight hesitation about people buying financial products when they're vulnerable, because as we move to a more marketised economy, we have had several mis-selling scandals, and I'm quite concerned about protection and regulation for people in that scenario.
Thank you. And then one towards the back.
Thank you. I'm Sarah McClinton, Director of Adult Social Care in Southwark. My question was for Andrew, really. I was very interested in what you were saying about the need to develop new styles of leadership or new models of leadership, and I was wondering if you could just say a bit more about that.
Could I start with that last question and put it both to Andrew and to Sarah? Kind of, how do you see leadership? What is this new model of leadership you're talking about?
Well, some of it is familiar in that we've been working in partnerships with people. I thought what Sarah was saying about working with CCGs bears out my experience entirely. But I think there are a couple of significant new challenges in the environment we're in. One is, I think, the ability to work across breadth, because whether you're working across several organisations or within one organisation across a lot of services, and Sarah was saying she's taken on adult learning and probably other things as well. So that, as it were, our current model is founded on a professional expertise, which is not going to fit the demands on top leaders. And the second one I'd highlight, it's not the only one, but the second one I'd highlight is, I suppose the best word descriptor is a commercial acumen. What are the paybacks on these big innovations? Who might invest in them? How might you assemble the right alliance of people to take it forward? What's in it for big private sector providers? What do we know about their ownership, their drivers, their capitalisation? You know, all of those things are very important to driving the things I was talking about, and they're not the things that the colleges have been training people to be expert at as public sector leaders.
And they're not training them to do that even today, are they? I mean, let alone 20 years ago or 30 years ago, whenever you started, Andrew. Yeah.
Well, I think they're doing more of it than when I started, but still more might be helpful. Okay.
Sarah, your views?
Yeah, I mean, I think no one leadership style will do one manager, one leader. I remember some years ago doing a leadership course based on Henry V, and the key message was the different leadership styles that Henry V used in different circumstances. He went out in the crowd and met the troops and used one leadership style, and he used a different style when confronting the battle. And that's what we need. We need a set. We need a portfolio of skills. It's no good saying, oh, I don't do detail. Well, sometimes you have to do detail. You also have to do strategy. Mm-hmm. You have to work with partners in a way that suits them. You have to know what the other side's leadership style is and the kind of things that suit them. It's not easy to train for, actually, partly because I don't come from a social work background. I do come from a social care background of the last 20 years or so, but I wasn't trained as a social worker, so I'm kind of coming from the kind of I became a manager and then a leader of a number of things. And as my portfolio expands back out to a set of different things like libraries and customer services and even supplies, would you believe it, and reprographics and things, you apply those skills differently in different settings. And I think it's all about the right style for the right audience at the right time.
But it makes it a much more exciting job, I would say.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Okay. Can I ask both of you, before we get on to the other question, are you working with paying for care in the way that Nottinghamshire is, in terms of your boroughs or Hertfordshire?
We're working with them, but not in the way that Nottinghamshire is.
Right.
And I think that there is, for us, a dilemma about putting people straight through to paying for care. I think everyone should have access, but I think it should be, for me, it needs to be in the pathway after we've looked at the needs. And I don't know whether that is the case, but I would not want someone to be phoning my customer service centre and put through to paying for care. I want to talk to them because I want to talk about enablement, free services, enablement, equipment, telecare. I want to prevent things before I start talking about funding their long-term needs.
Right, OK. Andrew?
No, we're not. We are working with a number of partners about information and advice and support people who are self-funders, but not in the way that Nottinghamshire have described.
Right. Chris, there was a specific question about paying for care and how it's constructed and funded.
So there were lots of elements to your question, so please come back to me if I don't answer them all, because I may not remember them all. Firstly, are there any other services? Well, in a way, paying for care is a sort of, not fully, but a sort of care advocacy service. I don't want to classify it as that because it isn't, but there are some that are. So My Care, My Home is one, subsidiary of Shaw Healthcare, who have established a care advocacy service which includes referring people to financial advice, and in their case they used paying for care as the gateway into financial advice. I saw the chief executive of Birmingham Citizens Advice Bureau a couple of weeks ago. She is desperately trying to set up a care advocacy service, which she will charge for, but the charge will be related to benefits that are gained through the advocacy service. And I think her planned model, it doesn't actually exist yet, but her planned model would be that the unless the individual sees a benefit over and above the charge that has been made within the first year, then the charge will be refunded, something along those lines. So there are others that are starting to develop. I don't think there's... Care Aware is one, which is, again, a telephone-based helpline that Suffolk and Norfolk County Councils are using. But there are not a huge number of them. You asked how it was funded, I think. Paying for care is... I need to go back a stage, perhaps. There are insurance products that exist that can fund people's care with guarantees, including the catastrophic costs. The way they work is that the individual is individually underwritten at the point of need, not in advance of care needs, so at the point of need, and at the point of need, we're dealing with a range of knowns, so it's easy to come up with a premium that has a guarantee attached to it. So in return for a single one-off premium, the insurer agrees to pay the care provider of that person's choice and the amount agreed, rising with inflation, for as long as that person lives. If they live beyond the cost of the premium, if you like, then they've done very well out of it. So the issue then, perhaps, is what happens if they die very early? So they part with a large sum of money and die the following week. So in the case of Partnership, the firm I represent, we have money-back guarantees built into the product. So if someone dies in the first month, then they have 100% premium refund. If they die in the second or third month, they have 50% premium refund. Fourth, fifth, or sixth month, 25% premium refund. From month seven, they're on risk fully. So they get no refund. Of course, they've had 7 months of fees paid then. The real winners are the people who live a very long time. Our average client lives 4 years in residential care. To give you some idea of premiums, they're not small. The average premium this year is £100,000. It pays out, on average, £23,000 a year. So if you can see that if you live for, and it's inflation linked, so if you live for 4 years, it's been good value for you. Interestingly, people who have relatives who have died in month seven have said it was the best thing we ever did. Yes, we haven't sort of made any money out of it, but it gave, in the case of the person I spoke to about it, it gave my mother such peace of mind that it was just worth it. She'd been in care for 6 months. She saw the money just whistling out every month, and they're quite large sums, and it terrified her. That was her biggest concern. And if we talk about well-being, and it's quite rightly at the heart of the bill, economic well-being is part of well-being. If you're constantly worried about whether your money is going to last or not and what choices you have if it runs out, then that needs to be fundamental to it. But to come back to trying to answer your question, how is it funded? We hope that by more people seeing financial advisors, more people will at least get a quote for a product like the one we sell. And if they do, we will sell more. We have no control over it. But we just think that if only 7% of people entering residential care are getting any financial, self-funders entering residential care are getting financial advice, if that number goes up, then at least in theory, we should sell more of our products. But we don't control it. Now, you asked about, sorry, it's a very long answer, you asked about regulation. I do want to answer that point because it is very important. You are absolutely right to be sceptical about the financial services sector. Why should anyone trust it? Well, you know, because there have been some horrendous scandals. The regulator in financial services is pretty tough. The most recent care-related scandal, the HSBC scandal, ended up with the business being shut down with a £10 million fine and £40 million in compensation. So that's a pretty scary regulator. Clearly, we can't guarantee that every advisor in the world is a good advisor. But what Paying for Care has done is to look at the range of advisors, and on the site, there are the very least they will be is properly qualified and regulated. A large number of them are also later life accredited, so members of the Society of Later Life Advisors or Symponia or other bodies of that nature. So we think we have put together a group of advisors who are amongst the best in the industry, and unless you can meet certain criteria, you won't get on to Paying for Care.
Will those advisors receive commissions?
No.
And will your company receive any payments from the local authorities for offering the pathway?
No. We receive no payment from local authority at all, and the advisors no longer receive commission. The Retail Distribution Review, which is a financial services piece of regulation, means that it has to be advisor-customer agreed charge up front. So no commissions are hidden away in the product at all. It's now illegal.
Can I suggest, because obviously a lot of you may well have a question, you nobble Chris in the coffee break.
Or my colleague, Nigel,
who's also at the back there. Paul, do you want to answer Trevor's question from Croydon?
Yes. I can also say in terms of, if you understand the pathway, and I think that's the important thing, Stephen, around how people come in, we know only a third of self-funders come through the local authority. So yes, in terms of that was a snapshot of our offer, we certainly will be offering people a full assessment, a prescription, reablement services, and we see going into a care home is obviously the last resort. For those people that, what we're trying to do though, and recognising that about two-thirds will make arrangements with the care home directly, is to get early notification. That's the key. So as soon as you can get early notification, and again, the system, if it relies on the bed system, again, it's only one part of our offer, but if it relies on the bed system, we'll get notification of that self-funder within 28 days at maximum. Normally, because the care homes are now working at using it on a regular basis, it's within the next day. In doing so, you get the opportunity for them to be offered, so it's not compulsory, so they're offered in terms of taken advice, and in doing so you get the maximum opportunity to benefit and to maximise their capital. If you don't and do nothing, then the next time you'll hear about the self-funder is when their savings fall out. And again, as just to reinforce, one of the key things for us, again, in the authority was that we only worked with people that offer fixed-based costings, and that was something that was important for us when we started to partner partnership.
Is anyone else desperate to ask a question? Yeah, there are three. We are running over a bit, but I'm keen to get people's contributions. So, woman over there, yeah, that's you. And then Sean as well, yeah, please.
Hi, thank you. If we haven't got time, because my question is probably going to be a little bit long. Well, not the question, but the response, I hope, is going to be a little bit long. I'm Dilek, and I'm from Matrix Consultancy, Matrix Knowledge. And I was really interested in hearing what Andrew and Sarah were saying in terms of the policy context, the financial crisis and all of that kind of stuff. And I think one of the things that sort of that we've been working on recently is around integration. And I think it underpins quite a lot of the work that the government's trying to do. And I'm really conscious that there isn't a lot of evidence out there that actually suggests that integration actually does deliver benefits in terms of particularly finances, which is obviously the biggest driver. And I was just wondering what, in terms of the Triborough and ADAS, what your thoughts were on that.
Okay. Sean, and anyone else want to ask a question? Yeah, and there's a woman at the back, Theresa. Right.
Thank you. Sean Walker, Service Director, Adult Care and Housing Operations for Wiltshire Council. I'd just like to take us back to the self-funders issue, and I understand I've spoken with you, Paul, about your bed system and early notification. But one of the key issues is that people often refer themselves to residential care because maybe their GP has advised them or somebody has decided they, when they really don't need residential care. So I'm particularly interested. We're, of course, doing something about it in Wiltshire, but what my colleagues are doing in their local authorities to work on the pathway that avoids people who make their own choices inappropriately to go into residential care.
Okay, and one more question at the back.
Anna Teresa Lefort from the RANSAC Association. My question is, you've talked a lot about care, but you've not talked about people's lives and how they, that seems to be all they've got to look forward for. And I feel like you're not touching on the very positive agenda, which is about their well-being, how they can stimulate their minds and how they can get on with their lives, whether it's in their own home or whether it's in care home or wherever. Sometimes they forget about that. And somebody mentioned their travel insurance, and I just want to say, being the state of travel insurance is so aided, and it stops people from going and doing their own thing and have to pay a high cost for very little return.
So, Andrew and Sarah, what's the impact of what you're doing on real older people? And we're going to touch on integration and partnership in the next session, so I don't want to spend too much time. But, you know, what are the actual outcomes of what you're doing for older people?
Okay. Well, I think, turning to the last question first, of course it's really important. Now, I think I did mention that briefly, for example, the older lady who'd learnt to read and the difference that would make to her lives. I was speaking particularly about this one day last week. And, you know, there are all sorts of examples. We need to enable people to live their lives because that will help their well-being. It's not about care if you don't need it. It's about engagement and not being isolated. Another example. So I talked about libraries. Libraries are well used by older people, and they can offer more than the chance to borrow a book. So we need to develop things that people can access in places where they go. The other example I gave last week was of our lunch clubs. Now, you might think, oh, that's care again. OK, so we did a review of our lunch clubs in Hertfordshire. We spend about £1 million on them out in the voluntary sector. But actually, lunch clubs are not just about lunch. In fact, that's probably the least of the issues. So, yes, they're about company. The thing that people valued most in our work in Hertfordshire was the exercise sessions they did, so the movement-type things they did when they went there, and also in Hertfordshire's lunch clubs, there are 600 volunteers, and guess what? Most of them are older people. So not only are people going to the lunch clubs, but people who don't need care are engaging in a volunteering way, supporting people in their communities, getting out and about and getting something from it. So we must use what's out there, and I think I've referred to that on my slide. If I just comment on the issue about the GPs and why people admit themselves to care homes, one of the things that we're doing in Hertfordshire, along with some other authorities, is working with on a project called Home Truths. And it's about helping GPs and hospital consultants understand how influential they are. I mean, they know they are, but influential in things that they're not expert in, actually. The most influential person in someone's truths about social care is their GP. And their GP doesn't, on the whole, know a lot about social care. So the Home Truths project is about how can we get out and, A, talk to GPs about how influential they are, and, B, try and use that influence in an appropriate way. And in hospitals, I think perhaps even more so, because there's too many admissions from care homes to hospitals, and sometimes it's because the person in the white coat said so, and then it's very hard for the social worker to say otherwise.
And do you think CCGs are changing that, or will change that?
I think there's an opportunity to change it, and I think that we're just meeting people we haven't had a chance to meet before. Yeah. We've always sent GPs information. They don't have time to read it. We have new ways of communicating with them, and I think it will help.
Great. Andrew?
If I echo a lot of what I say, certainly we are investing in things that enable people to live lives more independently. We have a lot of community-based activities. We sponsor a number of organisations that do that. I think there's a bigger issue, and I think the government's articulating this in a good way, but perhaps they need to be louder about it, which is that if we want a society in which it's a really good place to grow old and where you can live an effective and satisfactory life even when you have dementia, it's not the care system that's going to deliver that for you. We actually need houses, streets, shops, banks, television, internet, you know, the things that we all use that work for people in those. And that's something I think is a much bigger piece of work. On the care homes, so it really echoes what. So we did a review of the last 30 people that we admitted to care homes. We think 15 of those could be avoided if the consultant hadn't said you need to go to a care home. So I think I'm encouraged, actually, because our integration strategy does move a lot of work out of hospitals, and the conversation with our big hospital trusts has changed. 2 years ago, they were all about how can we be bigger, grow more, get more business in. Now they're about how can we get our expertise out into the community and still make a margin on it, because we know you can't afford the beds. So I think the hospital expertise will be coming out into the community, and we need to grab it and make sure that it works in a different way, and that's a big part of our integration strategy. And if we do that, to answer Dilip's question, if we do that, then it really will benefit, because we will have switched off the expensive old thing and we'll have the money to invest in the new innovative thing. But if we don't, then we'll just have added on another thing which is a marginal benefit but not generating the real benefits that we all know are there if we really go for them.
Thank you. I'm afraid we have run out of time for this particular session. But Andrew's actually set it up really nicely, the last answer, in terms of the next session, in terms of partnership, integration and work with housing in particular. So can I ask you to thank our four speakers this morning, Paul, Chris, Sarah and Andrew. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from policyreview.tv. For more details, go to www.policyreview.tv. Please note that this audio is subject to copyright and cannot be used by other broadcasters or for commercial gain.